welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. My name is Eric Klein, and on today's show, our guest is Joe Boyd. Joe Boyd is most well known for producing records in the 1960s. I will cherry pick some of the records that Joe Boyd produced. He produced records with Nick Drake in 1969. He also produced records with R.E.M. in 1985 and with Robin Hitchcock in 2014. Joe Boyd is the author of the book White Bicycles, Making Music in the 1960s. Joe has stories to tell, firsthand stories, about recording music, Pink Floyd's first single in the studio, firsthand accounts of Bob Dylan going electric at the Newport Folk Festival, and so many more stories. And he tells all those stories on a podcast that he hosted in 2015 called Joe Boyd's A to Z. And so I very recommend that if you're interested in hearing stories like that, you listen to Joe Boyd's podcast. It's why we are talking today on Radio Survivor. Today's interview is focusing both on Joe Boyd's podcast, A to Z, which aired 52 episodes and then is done, which is very on brand for Radio Survivor to do an interview with a podcast producer and host for a defunct podcast from 5 years ago that we love. Not only does Joe Boyd talk to us about his podcast, Joe Boyd's A to Z, which is still available and everyone should listen to, but we also, I discovered for the first time that Joe Boyd has a jazz radio show that he produced on Pacifica Radio in 1961 when he was 19 years old. And we talk about that as well on today's episode. Joe Boyd, thank you for joining us on Radio Survivor today.
A pleasure.
Well, I reached out to you because I'm a huge fan of your podcast, which is not what you're primarily known for, but I'd love to talk about the work that you put into your podcast and ask you how it is going and find out like how you approached making this particular piece of audio to share with the world.
Well, it's not going at all. I did it 4 to 5 years ago, I think. And I really enjoyed doing it, but I have a book to write. And I thought, after twice around the alphabet, for those who don't know, it's called Joe Boyd's A to Z, or A to Z for Americans. And it's 10-minute clips starting basically musical journeys triggered by a song starting with the letter in question. And I don't do it anymore.
Right. So
it just is up there and people listen to it and I get a report and people seem to keep listening to it. And sometimes it gets little surges and then it sort of goes back down a little bit. And at the moment it seems to be on a little bit of an uptick.
And the reason why I didn't know whether or not it was whether it was ongoing or not is when you left off, you didn't sign off and say goodbye.
Right.
When you got to when you did 40 26 times 2. When you did 42
52.
Oh, what a nice round number, 52. One for every week of the year.
That's right. Yeah.
But tell me about when you started at AA. What was going on for you to create the project, or not AA?
Well,
the first day.
Yeah. Well, a series of things, I suppose, came together and led me to start this project. I've been a record producer most of my life. I pretty much backed off doing that. I wrote a book called White Bicycles, Making Music in the 1960s, which did pretty well. And then I started about 12 years ago writing another book on the subject of what people used to call world music. And by now that won't be in the title. And I'm close to finishing the book. It's going to be finished next year and it'll be out in 2022. And it's a huge project, but it's been fascinating, and I've done wonderful research and listening and traveling into music from all over our globe. and particularly from the golden age of that. And as I write, I look at a wall which is filled with 6,000 LPs, and I look at a chest of drawers which has pull out on rollers drawers with little trays, which must have about 30,000 to 40,000 CDs. And then I have out in the hall, I have stacks and stacks of cassettes. And little by little, I'm digitizing the cassettes and the LPs. Not, and sometimes getting rid of the cassettes, but not getting ever getting rid of the LPs. Hmm. So my head has been full of music and of stories about music. Mm-hmm. And partly inspired, I suppose, by knowing the Kitchen Sisters, and also, you know, having listened to a lot of radio. I mean, I grew up in America. I used to listen to WBAI in New York, and I actually did a radio show for KPFK and WBFI, I mean, WBAI, when I was 19.
Oh.
I had a show called It's Tight Like That, which was jazz and blues from the 20s. And I, when I was going to Harvard, I used to go down to New York once a month and tape like three or four shows, hour-long shows. And then they would run every other week. I think I was in alternation with another presenter. And I, you know, I pop up on BBC radio quite a lot and being interviewed, and I have friends who are presenters and stuff. So radio's around me a lot. And the idea of a podcast was something in my head, and I started exploring what it could be. And I then investigated the legalities of playing records just on, you know.
Right.
And I discovered that as far as PRS, Performing Rights Society in Britain, was concerned, if you played less than 30 seconds of a track, you didn't have any obligation. And that gave me an idea. I thought, well, maybe, since I, you know, it's going to be telling stories and talking about history and triggered by music, I don't need to play the whole track. In fact, you might get in the way playing the whole track. So,
So your original idea was to possibly just have a like an hour long radio show that would spin records.
And then the alphabet part of it, I think, probably came from the way that I listen to music. My wife and I are kind of now pretty addicted to this methodology. Mm-hmm. I upload systematically, just idly on the side as I'm working on my book or anything else, I upload onto a big hard drive everything. And it's not all up. I've only maybe 15-20% of my collection is up there now. But that's a lot of music. It's, you know, 20,000 titles or something. And what we do is I put them in, I use iTunes as a medium, as a sorting to sort them.
Sure.
And I upload them at full strength. No MP3s are allowed. I do not listen to compressed sound. You know, go for the full 96K 24-bit, but it's CD quality.
Sure. Can you tell the listeners why you've made that choice? What can you hear the difference?
Oh yeah. I mean, there's no air around an MP3. And I suppose if you're listening to a modern record, which is made on a computer, and in a small airless little dead room.
Right. I mean, some music.
You don't really need the air. Right.
There's a lot of music that I love and listen to that has never was in the air. It is an entirely cyberspace sound.
Exactly. But even that, you know, you could probably tell the difference. But particularly if you're looking at a piece of music which was recorded with the Dizzy Gillespie Orchestra in a studio in New York, all playing together, you know, it definitely sounds very different.
Right. So none of your songs that you've been archiving digitally are compressed because you can hear, because you love the sound.
Exactly.
Because you love the sound.
Exactly. I mean, occasionally there's a couple of things that are the MP3s that have crept onto my hard drive because that's the only way I could get a hold of them. But I'm always very, very chagrined when something like that happens. But anyway, and so what I do is I have an iPod and I download like 500 tunes from the iPod in alphabetical order by song title.
Mm-hmm.
So I just go to, I click song on iTunes so they all fall into order. And I'll take the first, you know, start at the top of the alphabet, A through AC, and load those up onto my iPod and listen to them in the car, at home, in the kitchen, while I'm doing dishes, or even on some occasions cooking, or traveling. When the days when we used to travel, flying on an airplane, I don't even take a book. I just stick my head into my iPod and listen to whatever comes up. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating because that's one of the things that happens is that you get four or five different versions of the same song. And that's really the genesis of the podcast we're talking about is I was just fooling around and I looked at letter A, and I saw that I had like seven or eight versions of Ain't Misbehavin'. And I listened to them all, and they're really different. There's so many different things going on there, from Fats Waller's original to Bojangles Robinson tap dancing to it with Duke Ellington's orchestra, Louis Armstrong, Django Reinhardt, all these different approaches to that song. And I knew this, I had read a book about Andy Razaf, who's the lyricist.
Right.
And his extraordinary story of how he was the son of a Madagascar prince.
Yeah, an African prince.
Yeah, an African prince. And that just gave me the idea, well, that would be fun. I could probably do that. And somebody told me that 10 minutes was the optimum time for a podcast.
Huh.
And so
I feel like that is a very 2015 bit of advice.
Yes. And
but it's wonderful. It is wonderful that your show, you can sit and listen to six.
Yeah. And so I just thought I'd try it. And I actually, what happened was, I think, this is all a bit foggy because it's a lot of different things were going on then. But I was working on a project. I can't even remember what it was, but I was being asked to help on a project. It might have been something about James Booker, the New Orleans piano player, for the BBC. And the producer was a guy called Alan Hall from Falling Tree Productions. And I sort of pitched this idea to him. I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I need help. I need somebody who knows about radio or about stuff to do this. And he said, oh, that's interesting. And then one thing he said, well, look, I'm just too busy. And I said, well, listen, I've got this idea. I put some things down with a microphone. I've got some clips of music. Do you know somebody who could help me put this together? And he said, well, I use a guy called Pez Andrews a lot, and he has a little studio, And I said, well, where is he? And he gave me the address, and it was literally 5 minutes up the road from where I lived. And I thought, that's the guy I need to meet. And so I went and met Pez Andrews, and he was a great guy. And so I took him this sort of mess of ideas and fragments of Ain't Misbehavin', and he and I put it together in his studio, and we liked the result. So I said, "Oh, well, I guess I better find something for B."
How much of that first episode was written on paper?
I think very little. Oh. I think over the years.
Because I should tell you, because that is one of the, when I remembered how, we're speaking, I'll let the listeners know, we are speaking with Joe Boyd, who is the, who has done many things, but is also the producer of the podcast, Joe Boyd's A to Z, and we are talking on Radio Survivor today, in part because I realized I wanted to talk to you, because Toots, forgive me,
yeah, I'm gonna fix
this problem. Okay, we're talking today because Toots Hibbert passed away, was it last week? And I realized I know a lot about Toots Hibbert because of Joe Boyd's podcast. And then I couldn't believe that it was 5 years old. And that made me want to talk to you more than ever because I remember when it was brand new. But one of the things I told people about why I love your podcast is because it's scripted, not improvised. It's not jokers joking into a microphone until they're tired, taking turns, making each other laugh or telling their little stories. It's got a very, I had assumed that you wrote down your ideas.
Well, I do sometimes. And I think with Ain't Misbehavin', I knew the story so well. And I do like thinking on my feet and talking in complete sentences. I mean, one of the reasons I think I get called a lot to do interviews by the BBC about the history of music or whatever is because I'm very easy to edit. I talk in complete sentences. I sound scripted.
Yeah. Well, great job on the show because I had based on my work as a radio producer, I had assumed that you were going off a script because it was a very well organized set of ideas in every paragraph of your minute of your podcast.
Well, I don't want to claim that I'm never scripted because what would happen is I would put the music together on my computer and create a file that I would then take up to Pez's studio on a thumb drive.
Right. So you would have the even as much as a dozen songs for the 10-minute episode.
Little clips. Yeah. And I would even kind of crudely edit them for the bits that I wanted to use. And then
a sketch of your podcast.
And then I would put onto a piece of paper a list of all the songs in the order that I listed the things that I was going to play in the order I was going to play them. And then, depending on the subject, I would either put like key words in the gaps between the songs, and sometimes I would put whole sentences or paragraphs if a way to say something that I really liked came to me, I would write it down. But then when I would then be sitting in Pez's studio, I would look at the piece of paper and then put it away. And then just go with what I remembered from what I had for each segment, not the whole show all at once, but for each interval, interstitial.
And then how much of the final episode of the podcast, Joe Boyd's A to Z, How much of that did Pez build with you listening, or did he do a draft for you and then send it?
The way we eventually worked was we would pretty much do a rough cut when I was there. Mm-hmm. And then he would say, okay, I'm going to, and then he would go back to it and do stuff with levels and smooth out the segues and or sometimes if I was in a hurry or he was in a hurry, I'd say, look, you know what to do. I want to come in on this verse here right after I say this. And we would layer it up on his Pro Tools.
Sure. That's so good. So
that everything that I said was sitting in the right spot, roughly.
And then
and the music and sitting then, in the right spot.
And then this podcast that you did 52 episodes of, did you release episode A before you had shared episode B? Or I mean, at some point you were working in real time.
Yeah, I was doing it first. Yeah, for a while we started doing it. And oh, here's the other point of it was I then was looking for a platform.
Right.
And actually, Davia Nelson from the Kitchen Sisters suggested that I contact a company called Acast, which was just starting up as a Swedish startup company.
Right, because this is for listeners who have never tried to put their own podcast out into the world. The one of the most complicated and exciting steps is to decide who is going to host your audio so that people on the internet, on the World Wide Web, can listen to your audio at any time. And that's usually the most exciting step for many reasons, including the fact that that's where that's one of the only times you might have to spend money, no matter what else you have in your production plan. The host of the audio is sort of one of the most interesting bottlenecks of the podcast producer's list of questions to answer.
Well, I feel I was very, very fortunate because Acast was just starting up. And when I contacted them, they just opened a London office. And I think now they're very big players in this world. That's my impression. Mm-hmm. But I sent this first letter A to them. I might have even done letter B and sent it to them as well. I can't remember. But I sent them the sample. And then basically they came back and they said, sure. And then they started talking about sponsors. And they would need a place in the middle to insert a commercial and stuff like that. And I said, no. That wasn't what I had in mind.
Yeah.
And they said, well, I mean, that's how else do you expect us to? Otherwise, you know, we'd have to charge you a lot of money and blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. Said, oh, well, let me think about that, but I don't think that's going to work. Let me try and look for other, let me explore other options.
Yeah, this might be, again, one of the reasons why your podcast remains one of my favorites is I've been a listener and a connoisseur of non-commercial media my whole listening life, and I'm still a little bit hung up on being forced to listen to ads in my ears.
Yeah. And you know, I guess from the very beginning, and obviously I had to pay Pez to do it, I did not set out seeing it as a way to make money. My purpose in doing it, aside from the enjoyment and the sort of fun of trying this out as a medium, was that I had come to the realization that I was taking a very long time with my book and that it would not be ready in the next few years.
Right, your book on what was originally world music.
World music. Yeah.
And now you have to call it something else because world music is a very 90s.
Well, it's a very discredited, it is a discredited phrase.
Okay, well, maybe we can get into that later. I don't want to distract us
at
this point in the narrative.
So And I just like the idea that a podcast would keep me. I mean, I'd written this book that came out in 2006, White Bicycles, which has done incredibly well. I mean, I think I've sold about 75,000 of them around the world.
Because for listeners who aren't familiar with you, with your name or your work, your book was your memoir, and your life story intersects with I can't even put the right number on it.
Let me just correct you. I don't like to think of it as a memoir. Yeah. It is sort of a memoir, but it's a memoir not of my life, but of the 60s. It's very much a look at the 60s. It's the subtitle is Making Music in the 1960s. And so it's not really my personal confessions of a record producer or anything. It's what I observed and experienced in the music business and live touring and producing records in the studios in the 1960s. And I stretch the 60s to start in 1956 and end in 1973. And I used to produce a lot of records, but I haven't been producing many records lately because the music business doesn't make records the way I like to make records generally. And because I've been writing this book. And so I thought, well, a podcast, if it doesn't take up too much time, is kind of related to what I'm writing about. And it'll keep the pot boiling. It'll keep, if I can get a following of the podcast, it will help pave the way for the publication of my book. It was just a vague, it wasn't really a astutely figured out marketing idea.
Worst reasons to launch a podcast in 2015.
Yes.
It'll help me focus my work on my book and possibly build an audience.
Exactly. And then a day later or 2 days later, I can't remember if it was an email or a phone call from a woman at Acast. And she said that she'd been listening to my sample. And she liked it so much that Acast, they decided it would be good for Acast's image if they hosted it without commercials. And so that was, an incredible little gift of good fortune. And so up it went. And there it is.
Yeah. Well, we're speaking with Joe Boyd, who is the producer of the podcast Joe Boyd's A to Z in other parts of the world here on Radio Survivor. My name is Eric Klein. I think I'm excited about a handful of things that you have mentioned in the last 25 minutes. One thing you mentioned is this. You have written books. You have produced records. And now, and this podcast is like, it is a little bit silly in my mind, Joe Boyd. I've been actually thinking about talking to you and how it's kind of funny to interview you about the podcast and not, the records you've produced or the books you've written. But I think it's interesting also to talk about how the, podcasts are such a strange. One of the things that I'm excited about is you had a podcast in 2015, and I have a pet theory which could be entirely silly, navel gazing in the extreme. But I have a pet theory that podcasts sort of peaked in 2015 artistically. There was so much energy and innovation, and no one had quite figured out what they were going to be or how they would make money yet. More in my view of things, which could be very distorted, there was more innovation and experimentation and cool ideas being thrown up onto the internet for people to listen to at that time, even though I'm sure there's plenty now. But but it's exciting to ask you, you've written books, you've produced records. This podcast was something that you went back to in tiny little tidbits week after week, and I wonder if it if there's anything to recommend to that form of creativity.
Well, I really enjoyed it. I was a bit sad to stop it, but it had become, I realized I was spending too much time thinking about it, and that I realized that in the months and years, even before I started to, before 2015, when walking down a street, I would be thinking to myself, you know, that sentence, I'm starting that fourth paragraph of the last chapter. I don't think I like the sentence. I think I have a better way to start that paragraph. I would be having those kinds of thoughts in my head. And then I would go home, go onto the computer, open up the passage in question, and change the sentence. Or maybe do something even different.
And this is your book, not the podcast.
Yeah, my book.
Yeah.
And now, I found myself in 2015-16, I found myself walking down the street thinking, maybe I'm going to do double P next week. Maybe I should do, that would be cool if I did that and then linked in this, and then I could tell this story. And I realized it was just occupying, you know, I was then in my early 70s. I'm now in my late 70s. I don't have that much brain capacity, you know. So also time, you know, I was spending time fooling around with trying different ideas and stuff like that. And I just thought, I'll just get to the end of the second time around the alphabet and I'll draw a line under it and maybe I'll come back to it. But first I got to finish the book.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, I'm trying to do 52 episodes times 10 minutes is 520 minutes worth of storytelling.
Yeah.
It's just interesting to me. Like in a world where we're not worried about, why focus on the book more than the audio? Is it the audience that is waiting to receive it?
Well, I suppose ultimately I think a book is forever.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, my life was, I have to say, changed by White Bicycles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd produced a lot of records. And people, you know, a lot of people say to me, oh, my goodness, I didn't realize you know, I had that record for 25 years and I never even realized you produced it. I mean, people don't look at the name on the back of the record.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the things that I appreciated about your podcast when I discovered it 5 years ago. I was like, oh, my gosh, I owe Joe Boyd. I should thank Joe Boyd. And I never knew. Right. I mean, your podcast isn't entirely your own stories about the records you produced, but a certain percentage of the sounds are, you know, you played a role in helping get them to the ears of the world.
Yeah, and I mean the book is, I mean I have to say it's for me way more important than a podcast. I mean I've been working on it for like over 10 years.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a doorstop. It's going to be a big book.
Yeah, book about world music, which is no longer going to be about world music.
It's going to be about the golden ages of global music, about the backstories of salsa and samba and reggae and Graceland and, you know,
the Paul Eastern Simon European, album.
Yeah, Balkan music, whatever. The stories of how this music got to us and the feedback loop and all of the sort of great stories that I mean, there are fantastic stories in there. And it's been wonderful for me to dig into all of them and research them and discover them and enlarge upon them. And I'm very gratified. I'm confident the book will be well received and people will like it because I threw it out there last summer, a year ago, to publishers in Britain, and we had a bidding war.
So, yeah. And
so I'm excited about it.
I love the
music. And I've never had a bidding war about my podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
To answer your question.
Yeah, and I love both things. And when I read the book in the future, I will have to become my own audiobook radio producer. I'm going to have to go to the streaming services that I, whichever ones I am at that moment giving my money to, I'm going to have to program my own listening to hear all the great music that you're describing the stories of in your book. And what I love about your podcast, Joe Boyd, is that I don't have to do that work. I get to sit back and listen to the stories and the sounds that go with the stories. And I think that that's also very exciting, right? I mean, books have been around for a long time, a beautifully long time, and we know what to do with them. And audio storytelling is relatively new in comparison, and it's not really clear yet, right? Do we, there's audiobooks could have been, I mean, talking on records has been a part of records the whole time, but they were short in the beginning. And so now that go ahead.
I have to say, Eric, you just gave me an idea. And maybe this, who knows, this might be a historic moment. because one thing for sure, I produced my own audiobook of White Bicycles. Mm-hmm. I read it myself. And I, working with an engineer, I edited it. And in my negotiation with the publisher for this next book, I insisted that I would do the same with the audiobook. Mm. And I've, resisted any attempts on their part to approve or possibly suggest somebody else to read the book or to produce it themselves. I'm going to produce it. I'm reading it. But you just gave me an idea, which is in the audiobook, the 30-second rule could apply equally well.
Yeah.
Maybe. Although maybe not, because I think the artist's rights are not the same, perhaps, in an audiobook which is sold.
Yeah, I know it can get very complicated. We've talked about it on Radio Survivor quite a bit.
Yeah, I think actually, I take it back. It probably wasn't a great idea.
No.
Okay.
but it is a good idea as for the listeners, and it is a good idea for the art form. It's not a good idea at all once you have to consult the lawyers, who I'm not trying to run down the work of the lawyers. We do appreciate artists getting paid for their work when their work is being used in other places.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. One of my favorite radio producers would essentially over his his name was Don Joyce, and Don Joyce worked at KPFA making radio for decades. And essentially Don Joyce would, some days his work on the radio, late night radio, was very surreal and very chaotic. But a lot of his episodes, which are available on archive.org now, they're being archived by his former collaborators and coworkers with the band Negative Land. A lot of the work is essentially like pirate documentaries. Don Joyce, one of my favorite episodes that I recently listened to of Don Joyce is his 4-hour chaotic soundscape of a radio program that's very surreal and very innovative. He's also making new connections about the work and the music of Brian Eno in a way that is, this particular episode of his radio program is one of my favorite Brian Eno sound documentaries. But if Don Joyce needed to make a CD and release this Brian Eno documentary, it would be impossible. The rights to the music would stop the project. And that has come up on Radio Survivor more than twice. We've also talked with a lot of archivists.
Yeah.
who are doing very important work to preserve the sounds of radio interviews, the very important work of preserving sounds of records. But it then becomes very complicated to allow people to access those sounds.
Yeah, I mean, people say to me when I talk about my book, they say, oh, are you going to have a CD or two enclosed with the book? I say, well, if I did, the composers and artists on the CDs would get all the royalties.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be possible. So it's a whole different world of rights.
But I'm happy that your podcast exists. Let's put it that way. Because
so am I. I just went back and re-listened to it for the last few weeks. I've been listening every morning. My wife and I get a cup of coffee and listen to one of them.
Huh.
And I've been in, you know, some of them I think could have done that better, but a lot of them I think, oh, that's very nice.
Which instead of me doing it, which one would you recommend listeners start with? I mean, A, obviously.
Well, yeah, A is fun to start with. I can't remember what they are. Let's see. I quite like L in a way. It's fun because it's cross-cultural. It's one about the horse races.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a very good example of the way that you're making on your show, why I like your show, the way that you're making these connections.
Yeah.
Across the entire spectrum of songs,
yeah.
Right? And how, you know, if you're not limited to genre, the way that radio defines genre, yeah. Music genre, or the way that CD marketplaces define genre, there's a lot to be said about a lot of music.
Well, and I think one of the things I enjoy about the process and one of the reasons I took to it and enjoyed doing it is because I like discursive conversation, you know, where you start out talking about one thing and then something that is mentioned there leads you down a little side road into a whole other thing.
Right. I should let listeners know, because I just I blasted right through it. But the L episode that you're referring to is a series of songs, half a dozen songs, each one about horses.
Yeah, they're all sort of triggered somehow by, because the L, I guess this is not a spoiler to give away the fact that L stands for Long Shot Kick the Bucket, which was a very famous ska number from Jamaica in the 60s about a horse race everybody was betting on that fell and died before he reached the finish line.
Yeah.
And then it made me think of other songs from American country and tango and other places that are about horse races or horses that died. Anyway, that's...
Yeah. Well, and that's why I like your podcast, Joe Boyd A to Z, because it makes those connections.
Yeah.
You know, let's... Joe Boyd, we could go on... I want to talk again. I want to go back to talk about your radio program. It's Tight Like That. Your jazz radio program. So it aired on WBAI and on KPFK, the New York affiliate of the Pacifica radio station and the LA affiliate of the radio station, the radio network, when you were very young.
When I was very young. And again, it's like amazing things have happened to me. I guess if you would just assume that they might, sometimes they do. I was obsessed with visiting collectors when I was in my teens and taping their 78s.
Uh-huh.
And I had a big collection of, I had a Wallenzack tape recorder and a big collection of reel-to-reel tapes with 78 RPM blues and jazz. On them. And when I left Harvard for half a year and went to work for a record company in LA, and I started listening to KPFK, and I heard Phil Elwood, who was actually a San Francisco Bay Area based jazz broadcaster and writer. And he had a show, And I thought to myself, completely naive. I mean, completely stupid and naive. But, you know, hey, I was 19. I said, I'll go out to KPFK, because I didn't realize that he wasn't in L.A. Mm-hmm. And I'll offer to swap him. He could copy some of my tapes, and I can maybe tape some of his collection.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And, tell me about Phil Elwood's show a little bit. Why did it matter?
Well, it was a jazz show on KPFK, and it played a lot of old stuff. And, you know, he talked. He was entertaining, and he talked about old jazz and blues. And, you know, I can't even remember that well, but I only heard it once or twice, and I thought, well, I'll go. And I found out where the station was, and I just kind of went out there and knocked on the door.
In Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, well, Phil Elwood isn't here. He's in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And I said, oh. And this guy just happened to come out when I was there, and he said, what's this conversation about? I was talking to the receptionist. And I told him. And he said, come into my office. And it turned out he was the boss. And he said, what kind of records do you have? And so I started talking about, well, I've got some Tampa Red with George Tom, and I've got, you know, all these rare things. I started, you know, banging on about how cool they were.
Because you also had your tapes.
Yeah, so I had my tapes.
The archives of other people's 78
collections. Other people's collections. Yeah. And so he said to me, would you like to do a show yourself?
Wow.
And I said,
the early 1960s, right?
This is 1961, yeah. And I said, well, I never thought about that, but sure. And so he said, well, come in here next weekend on Saturday, and you can have some time in the studio and just do a little 15-minute sample of what you would do, you know. And he said, we got a lot of jazz records here in the library. You can use some of them. You can use your tapes. You can use whatever you like. And so I did. And I came up with the idea of calling it It's Tight Like That. And and then he said, okay. Every other, because it turned out that Elwood, I don't know, there was some rivalry between KPFK, I later discovered, between KPFA and KPFK. And Elwood gave them one every other week or something, and they, I don't know, I can't remember the whole politics of it, but they liked the idea of generating their own program.
I'll check in with our Radio Survivors founder, Matthew Lazar, is the Pacifica historian. Right. He's written two books. I'll see if he can fill in any details.
You could tell him I had accidentally significant role, because what happened in Pacifica's history, because when I went back east, WBAI had just started to take my show. KPFA wouldn't touch it. Phil wouldn't like it.
Oh, no. Sorry to hear that. And just because we're nerds here, your show was recorded onto magnetic reel-to-reel and mailed across the country?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was in 1961. How else?
I don't know. There's always a way, right? There's not much of another way.
Right. And so they arranged with BAI because they said they wanted more of my shows. So I arranged with BAI that I could go into BAI and record them in New York.
Huh.
And they would send them out to KPFK. And so at one point, when I was really into it, I was doing like every other week. So I would come down from Harvard to New York, do three or four shows. And then I had this ambitious idea that I would do a series on the blues, because I interviewed this guy who did a lot of field recordings in the South, called Harry Oster. Mm-hmm. I would do the blues as folk music, and then I would do the blues as popular music. And I persuaded Ahmet Erdogan from Atlantic to do an interview with me, although he in fact never did it. And then I had this other idea. The third part of this blues idea was to interview somebody on the subject of the blues as jazz. Mm. And I called up a guy who was doing a show for non-commercial radio in Philadelphia, who I used to listen to when I was growing up in Princeton, New Jersey. And he had written a book about Bessie Smith. Mm. And he was a Dane or a Swede who had moved to America. And anyway, I called him up. He was very nice. And he came up to New York and he did my show, as did Harry Oster. So I had the blues as jazz with Chris Albertson. And Chris Albertson had never been to the WBAI. He was a Philadelphia guy.
Yeah.
And he came in and did my show. And he looked around.
Do you know which station? I hate to ask you a question.
I can't remember what station.
The Philadelphia station. Yeah, we'll figure it out someday. Right.
But the key part of this story is that 2 months later, when I came down to BAI to do my recording, who was the new head of the station? Chris Albertson. He had been fascinated by it and had stayed around after, because I think I had to leave, and I introduced him to somebody at the station. And I said, he works at a station in Philadelphia, blah, blah, blah. And I left them to it. And I came back, and there'd been some big turmoil in BAI, as usual. And next thing I know, Chris Albertson has moved to New York and is the head of BAI, and was for many years, I believe, after that.
You're the host of a radio program on jazz that you were a giant fan of in Philadelphia, was a guest on your show at WBAI when you were a teenager, and then became
the head of... That's right. Well, I was 20 by then.
Okay.
I was 20 by then, yeah.
Forgive the hyperbole. Well, that's wonderful. I wonder... Do you know if any of your, if the archives of your show exist?
I stayed in touch. In fact, you probably have seen me talking about this, but you may have forgotten, because I assume a person like you has seen the documentary on Bob Fass.
I apologize, but I love hearing about things that I should have known about.
Okay. Bob Fass had a show on BAI for years and years and years called Radio Unnameable. Mm-hmm. And there's a documentary by that name. Mm-hmm. And his whole archive is been taken in by the Film Archive downtown New York, I think, or somewhere. But anyway, somebody connected with the it's FAS, Bob FAS.
Yeah, I'm writing it down.
And there is a very interesting documentary, and I'm interviewed in it because I was on his show a number of times. I used to do the little inserts and that he would play late at night. And he was a friend of mine. And he's considered a pioneer of radio, of weird radio.
Yeah, I wonder, can you tell the listeners who may not be familiar with how radio has sounded in the decades in which you're familiar with radio, what was he doing that was important? Because it's sometimes easy to forget, you know, like I have a fascination with the idea that something that is now painfully obvious to everybody might have been an innovation, you know, as recently as the 1960s.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a complete innovation. I think it was every Friday or every Saturday night, Bob Fass would come into WBAI at either 11 or midnight and just take over the station all night long.
Uh-huh.
And people used to come in. He would invite musicians to come by. People would just come in, pull themselves up in front of a microphone, start playing. Other musicians would jam. Different people came in, read poetry. He would ask people who made shows for BAI to make him a little segment. And And I used to do that sometimes. And that's the story that I tell in the documentary, which is an amusing but shameful or sort of embarrassing for a young guy who thinks he's hip. I made him a little 15-minute segment once, which was all about dope songs. Like If You's the Viper and songs that had references to smoking dope. And at this age, I think I'd had one puff on one joint. And so I talked about these, I introduced these records in a kind of funny way.
Right.
And then I gave him the tape. And then the next time I came down, I ran into Bob Fass at the station. He said, "Oh, Joe, I got to play you something." And he had an air check of the show that the previous weeks before when they played my segment. And his special guest was a comedian called Hugh Romney.
Uh-oh.
Who later was famous as Wavy Gravy, the guy who was the host at the Woodstock Festival and became a kind of countercultural hero. But at the time, he was Hugh Romney, who was a kind of hipster comedian, stand-up comedian, a la Lenny Bruce kind of thing in New York nightclubs. And so he was the guest when Bob played my segment of dope songs. And Bob plays the end of my segment, and then you have this silence. And then Hugh Romney says, "Man, Joe Boyd is about as hip as day camp."
It's your epitaph. How funny.
So, yeah, so I was sort of mortified but amused.
Well, I think I'll go out on a limb and say you've done the work to become more hip since those years.
Yeah.
How funny! How funny for you to be mocked on the radio permanently.
Yeah.
Well, but I appreciate that you were trying to do that work of making those connections. That's really interesting to me as a fan of your podcast, Joe Boyd's A to Z, where you take songs in a not in an arbitrary order, but in a really interestingly chaotic order, because your podcast begins with the approach of song titles in alphabetical order and sort of weaves together the meaning and the stories that are connecting those songs. Not always. You don't always have to stick with that starting point. But it's funny that you've been doing that work your whole life. I like it.
Yeah, I mean, I like following threads, you know, just wherever they lead. You know, some of those shows, some of the podcasts stick with the subject matter. Some of them stick with the artist who sang it or performed it or the region or the style or something like that. But it always starts with something that kicks off an idea. I just like letting my mind wander.
My thanks to Joe Boyd for being our guest today on Radio Survivor. If you'd like to listen to a longer version, we have about 17 more minutes of radio interview with Joe Boyd. It's available on our podcast online at radiosurvivor.com or wherever you get your podcasts. They'll also have show notes today, links to Joe Boyd's podcast, Joe Boyd's A to Z, which again, highly recommended. Everyone should check out this 5-year-old podcast because I love it. You can email us. Our address is podcast@radiosurvivor.com. My name is Eric Klein. On behalf of Paul Rees-Mandel and Jennifer Waits and Matthew Lassar, thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.